Hello and welcome to the Musicians Map podcast. My name is Kane Power. This week is part two of a two-part podcast with engineer, musician and bar owner Tom Anderson. In part one, we talked about booking a tour as an independent band. And in part two, we're talking about achieving the best onstage sound possible so you can deliver the best representation of your music. We're going to talk about rehearsal, gear, sound checks, set list, stage monitors, sound engineers, and how drugs and alcohol can affect your performance. This is important listening for those getting ready to gig and essential for people already playing gigs. Here's how to make the most of your opportunity on stage. Also, at the end of the podcast, I'll be giving you a free gig prep checklist to download and go through before your next gig, so stay tuned for that. So without further ado, here's part two. I mean, we've all had shitty sound on stage, and especially when you're starting out and you've got no idea what you're doing or what to do, or you know, what to do right. First, I just want to quickly cover why we need to think about how we sound on stage. And it's things like representing your band, representing your music to its fullest. I think that when you achieve a good sound on stage, you know, you're able to concentrate more on your performance and therefore, you know, be more convincing to your audience, which makes it immersive for your audience and will gain you that audience as fans. So would you agree with that? That's generally why you kind of want to sound good while you're on stage?
Well, why you're doing it, I guess. Again, you know, generally if you're playing a show and you're not a professional musician, you're paying in some way to be there, like in terms of taking time off work or, you know, traveling or whatever. You've put a lot of time and effort into practicing, writing, gear, all that kind of stuff.
Do yourself a favor.
Do yourself a favor. Turn up to a show and, like, and, you know, blow some minds. And it's like, and if you can make, your band sound good, with just vocals and a kick drum going through the PA, then with a full system, you're going to sound good, you know, because that means that you can hear everything that's going on stage. And if all your tones are exactly, you know, they're your tones, you know, thinking about sounds, I think is, you know, and again, you don't have to reinvent the wheel. You know, if you're a rock band that sounds someone like the Foo Fighters, what do the Foo Fighters use? What sort of sounds are they getting? And is it the sound that you want? And it's quite easy to kind of try and replicate those kind of things with that particular gear. Making sure that the bass guitar isn't three times louder than the guitar on stage, because then the person out front is going to be battling with that, and the guitarist is, and the drummer's going to keep going, I can't hear the guitar.
So it's you want to sound good for yourselves and for the benefit of your audience to just make the whole thing good. You just basically you don't want to sound like crap. That's
the most important. Well, I don't. Some people might. I really don't. I really enjoy sounding good.
Yes,
it feels good when you play music and it sounds good.
That's,
you know,
right.
Like, you know, like you hit a drum, like a well-tuned, freshly skinned drum. It's like, oh,
it's almost like a physical.
Yeah, it is totally. Yeah. And when I play a freshly stringed bass through some really nice pedals through a big Ampeg stack, I'm like, this feels good to play.
Yeah,
you know, if I'm playing through like a, you know, a little combo amp that sounds like it's farting, it doesn't feel that good.
Do you
to play
better as well when you sound good?
Of course you do, totally. And I think that's the thing that I understood, especially being a horn player when I was younger, and I feel for anyone in high school that are trying to learn, you know, any instrument that you're borrowing from, you know, an under-resourced music department.
Yeah.
That, you know, I started off, like, I played recorder and then clarinet and then saxophone. And then I think it was for my 21st, some family members kind of chipped in and bought me a real nice sax, which later got stolen, which is another reason why you should always take your gear inside.
Yeah.
But all of a sudden I could play like 100 times better because I was using a nice instrument. And, and financials come into that, of course. And I don't want to get classist about it, but it's like, you know, if you're trying really hard on a Samick guitar that's set up really badly, or a cracked old clarinet, or a drum kit which has never been reskinned and basically has skins made out of gaffer tape.
Mm.
If you're a professional musician, you can probably make them sound good. But if you're learning and you're just starting out, it makes it so hard you might end up giving up. You
yeah.
know? And then all of a sudden you start playing gear that's really good, or if you can borrow it or whatever, it becomes so much more enjoyable. And you become such a better musician because you're not having to fight against the technical, you know, difficulties of having bad equipment.
Yeah, and that is a point that I wanted to make about one of the first things to do is have decent gear.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, it can be a bit of a financial thing, but it doesn't have to be.
Mm.
You can make the most of your cheaper gear.
Mm-hmm.
Things like if you have a cheap drum kit, you know, maybe save up a tiny bit and reskin it and learn how to tune it.
Yep.
That'll make a huge difference.
Totally.
Decent cymbals, microphones, you know, in one of my last bands, the bassist was such a good bassist, and he'd been playing for 15 years or something. Mm-hmm. And he had the crappiest bass, and every rehearsal it was crackling and it would drop out, and he'd have to shake it and, you know, I just have to take this bit off and fix it. And it was so cheap, and it wasn't, you know, he had stickers on it, and I think that's why he liked it,
right?
Because he liked his stickers.
I can empathize with that.
But after, like, we convinced him, you know, he was playing in two different bands, hardcore and reggae, and we convinced him, dude, spend £500 and get yourself a Fender jazz bass or a PA, just something mid-range, just something second-hand. And so I think he spent £400 on a second-hand bass, and he was just enlightened.
Yeah.
So it really doesn't take that much just to make the tiny step up. And as you say, it will make you a better player.
Yeah, and that could be something you work at as well. It's like anything, I think. You know, like, I have friends who are constantly borrowing other people's equipment and stuff, and they're, you know, they're broke, and they can't afford a nice bass. But they do have friends who have nice gear, and so they'll borrow a nice bass or whatever, you know. and it makes such a difference to playing, and, you know, even down to, like, you know, I played a show last night and I bought new picks, and I didn't even buy them. The bass player from the band before us, his bass was crapping out, like the string kept falling off the nut. So I was like, okay, use my bass. I'll show you how to restring your one. Just get me some picks from the shop, you know. It's like $2.
Yeah.
It's like a dollar a pick or something, you know. But it's like, because I had a new pick and I wasn't using some old nubby thing, I played way better, you know. Yeah. And it's like, and that was just a dollar, you know. So that's you know, good gear doesn't mean you have to have a $3,000 head and a $2,000 guitar and, you know, monster cables that have been, you know, sold by a snake oil salesman, you know. Like, it's like you can just get solid stuff that works, and then, you know, spend $20 on a pack of strings and restring your guitar. Or
and keeping it in good condition.
Yeah.
I think as well, keeping your bass, if we're using a bass as a good example, but get it serviced every now and then, get it set up, or learn how to set it up yourself, you know. So,
or make friends with a person at the guitar shop, like I did, and be like, yo, if I get you a box of beers, do you reckon you could kind of tweak my bass? And then when I got my bass professionally set up, again, it's a whole new instrument. It's like, you know, that those weird rattles and those little things that, or if it's set up so the strings are way off the fretboard, and, you know, you've got bigger muscles in your fingers than you do in your legs, you know, because you're having to push them down all the time. All of a sudden that goes away, and you're like, oh my god, I can, like,
faster.
Totally, all that kind of thing, and more consistent.
Yeah, so keep your gear serviced, new strings, play them in, get rid of your shitty leads, you know.
I literally have a box of about 80 shitty leads next door, and I just, you know, I'll get round to fixing those one day, you know. And then, I was just on tour, and I left my really nice leads that I bought, I left them at a festival or something. I don't even know how I did it. Like, I never do stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I had to buy some cheap ones. And straight away, one of them was microphonic, meaning, you know, you could tap the cable and you could hear it coming through. The other one was crackling, and it was just like, oh, man. Like, and I really noticed the difference between just having some cheap, crappy leads and having my nice ones, which in the scheme of things wasn't that much more expensive to buy. You know, I wasn't spending the whole gig thinking, oh, that weird kind of whistling noise that's coming through, or that weird crackle every time I turn to the right or whatever isn't happening. You know?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's important. Mm. Do you think the genre does play a part in it, though? Because I'm thinking using cymbals as an example.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, I've always preferred nice, shiny, bright, you know, expensive cymbals, and I've spent years saving money, you know, to buy my nice cymbals, because that's how I wanted to sound, right? But if how you want to sound is different, maybe you could get away with cracked, broken, you know, stacks and...
Yeah, totally, depending on genre. But also, I think there can be an obsession with particular, you know, like, using cymbals as an example, you know, like, I want to have this Zildjian K series dark, blah, 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 whatever. And our drummer recently didn't fly cymbals over to Europe and bought some over there and just kind of shopped around. He had the ones he wanted to get.
Mm.
And then he kind of went around and just tried a whole bunch of different ones, because his ones were all cracked and hard, and he was having to play 6 times harder at practice than he had to. And he was like, I don't want to do 20 shows in a row.
Yeah.
Where I feel like I'm basically running uphill with a, you know, backpack full of rocks.
Yeah.
So bought some new ones, but shopped around and was like, I'll try all these different ones. And they happened to be half price or whatever. So he's like, okay, I'll go with this one. Saved himself, like, if you're buying a set of cymbals, like, that's like $1,000, you know? And we got to the first show playing with our German friends. We did a series of shows with a gym band that we're friends with, and their drummer had the exact same cymbals, and he'd done the exact same thing.
Yeah.
And he was like, and they were both like, yeah, we both get to listen to how these cymbals sound, you know, from other people.
Yeah,
and
it's like,
and it was just that they both didn't have much money, but they both wanted that level of professionalism. So they shopped around, you know, talked to different people in the shops and things, tried them against, you know, your standard, you know, like you referred to a Fender Jazz or P bass, you know, that would be your, you know, an industry standard instrument, you know, like Zildjian or Meinl or whatever would be an industry standard cymbal. But there might be some cheaper brands that sound just
still
as good,
good,
but don't have a label on them or whatever. Yeah. You know?
And never be afraid to go secondhand with gear. I'm really guilty of that when I was younger. I needed new stuff. Even though I was poor, I still needed new stuff. But now I'll buy anything secondhand. Doesn't matter.
Yeah, totally.
Because you can still get amazing quality, especially if you're on a tight budget, you can upgrade to the intermediate level of something.
For sure. Yeah.
I mean, secondhand.
Yeah, playing bass, I was borrowing a friend's 20-year-old, it was an amazing instrument, but it was just a little Squire jazz bass. But they were one of the old Japanese ones. And you can get a Squire jazz bass now that's made in China or whatever, and it sounds terrible. But there was a period where
they're good.
They were really good. And so I was using that, and then a friend of mine gave me their American jazz bass, and I was like, that's amazing, thank you. because they wanted to encourage me to play bass. And then there was a friend who worked at a backline company who had an American P bass, and well, he's a promoter, and he used to hire it out to all the bands that used to go through, and he needed some money, and I got this amazing American P bass for way cheaper than, it would have been like $3,000 buying it new or something, and it was like $1,000 or something.
Nice.
And it was, and it's amazing.
It's a pro instrument.
It's a pro instrument. I rent it out to touring pro bands when they come through and they need a backup bass.
Yeah.
I rent it out to them, and then I make some money back on
it.
And that's the difference when you get to that level that you can do that, you know? So.
Nice. Good words. Okay. So your gear is good. We know that. Rehearsing.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, bands need to be rehearsed. It kind of goes without saying a little bit. I mean, some people might rock up after a couple of rehearsals and play a punk gig or hardcore gig or something, and that's fine. But if you want to be, if you want to sound really good, you kind of need to be rehearsed, right? So for people that are just starting out, before they've even played their first gig, how do they know that they are tight? How do they know that they're kind of, that they're ready?
There's a bit of a chicken and the egg thing, I think, because you get tight from playing shows. You get tight from rehearsing a lot, but you see bands that spend a lot of time, obviously, in their garage or whatever, and that could be like several times a week, and then they go and play a show, and it's just like, it's a totally different buzz, you know?
Yeah.
So make sure you can listen to everyone else in the band, or the people that you need to listen to, you know? And record yourselves. I think this is something
that's
been you know, and nowadays on, you know, if you're playing in a band, it's more than likely you've got a phone, a smartphone or something, even a cheap one. Mm. the recorders on those are great. We use them at practice. Yeah. Every single practice, we're writing a new song, you know, we'll just chuck it on the floor. I'll just chuck it anywhere, you know, like if I'm recording a drum kit, I'm going to spend, you know, ages finessing about the placement of microphones or whatever, but if I'm in a band practice, I'm just going to chuck my phone on the floor and hope for the best. And generally it sounds great.
Yep.
And then you can listen back and you can go, whoa, what was going on there? Mm. And I know drummer friends particularly have said that that's the main thing, because otherwise it's like our voices. Like, I don't know what I sound like until I probably listen back on this or on an answer phone or something. I'm like, oh my God, my voice sounds horrible.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You don't know until
you don't know until you listen back. Yeah, and I'm constantly doing that. I always try and get people to video the gigs that we play and things like that, because even if no one else is watching it, it's like for me to look back and go, I felt like I was having a terrible gig, but actually that was really good. Or I felt like I was having a really good gig, but that was actually played really slowly.
Yeah.
Or,
and the, you know, we're speeding up there. Yeah, didn't feel like we did that live. Yeah,
exactly. That kind of thing. So, yeah. And kind of arranging yourselves. I'm fortunate that I practice at a venue. So that makes it a lot easier. But arranging, I think it's really easy if you're all practicing facing each other in a circle and that's what you're used to in a tiny little noisy garage where everything's echoing around, then all of a sudden you're on a bigger stage and you're all spread out.
You can't see anyone.
You can't all of a sudden hear all the things you're used to hearing. That's where you're kind of looking around halfway through the song going, where are we?
Yeah, yeah. What's the cue? Where's the visual cue?
Totally.
Yeah.
So knowing if you're well rehearsed, I think is practicing, recording yourselves and maybe getting to the point where you practice as if you're playing a show, you know?
Yeah.
and I'm a big believer in rehearsing. If you're going to be playing shows, rehearsing sets. Mm. I don't like, unless you're Bruce Springsteen and you have amazing charisma and personality, playing a song, stopping, fiddling around, tuning for 10 minutes and then playing the next, this song's a new one. And then playing the next song, that doesn't make for a good show. It has never made for a good show.
Unless you're really, really funny.
Yeah.
And then
it just gets annoying after a while. It's true. Like,
this song is for my grandma.
Yeah. I'm a big believer in, unless you've got something important to say, shut up between songs as well.
Yeah.
And that doesn't go for everybody, but even say nothing, you know, like.
Yeah.
It might add, depending on your style of music, you know, it might add to it. Or, you know, you have to do the whole, if you're a charming country singer or something like that, you know, like, and you got to talk to the crowd and you get them involved and things like that. Mm. That's a different thing as well. But running, you know, how you run songs into each other, planning the dynamics of your set, all that kind of stuff, and then recording that, you know, like, again, you're spending time, money, effort.
Mm.
And for some of us, it's been a, you know, 20 years of a lifestyle or more, like, just put a bit of effort in.
Yeah.
You know, regardless, like you said before, like, you know, unless you're a punk or a hardcore band, you can have a couple of practices. I still, any genre doesn't mean it needs to be shit, you know? Like, just put some effort in. Like,
yep.
It's not that hard to do, and the result will be so much more.
Yeah, big on recording your rehearsals. So how often do you reckon you should rehearse? I know it's different for everybody.
It is.
I used to rehearse maybe one serious rehearsal a week and then one writing session.
Right. That's good.
Usually.
I mean, that's amazing. I mean, it depends on everyone's, you know, time frames. I'd love to have been in that situation where I lived in a house with all my bandmates and we just practiced every day.
That'd be amazing, yeah.
Generally, I practice, we'll have a band practice once a week, and like if you can get a regular, I mean, again, it depends on the dynamic of the band and the personalities and all that kind of stuff,
yep.
But I've always, what's worked for me and for most of my friends is the having a regular rehearsal spot.
Mm.
But then I've had bands where I've had members living in different countries, and, you know, a few of us will get together and do some writing stuff. PCB Eagles started with a drum machine and us just writing some riffs. Actually, it was a Logic loop running around. and which led to some weird timing because I think I had a bad loop. But and then sitting in a room for 2 days, smashing out the songs and then going off and playing a gig or a tour or whatever, you know, wow. because that's a necessity of yeah. it. And I've got friends who live in multiple different countries and that's the way they see it. It's like you stay in contact and you kind of keep doing things and then you get together and, you know, practice for a day and then go and do it.
Yeah.
But for what I've found works the best for me and current band is having a regular rehearsal spot yep. every week.
You can rely on.
You can rely on. Even if all you're doing is getting together and playing the set, that's good.
Mm. Yeah, and I do want to... We touched on set lists just before, and I think they're really important as well.
Mm.
And I agree that if you don't have anything incredibly useful to say or you're not really naturally charismatic, you should probably just not talk between songs. If you feel like you need to talk and there are specific things that you feel like you should say, it sounds a bit contrived, but I would plan those as you plan your set list and write a note, you know, beside the song. This is where you thank the band before you. If you have to say something, I would plan it because I've been in the situation many times in different bands and they go, oh, you have to say this and I have to say this and I have to say this between songs and then they forget. And so you're sitting there waiting for them to say it and there's 10 seconds, there's 20 seconds goes by, there's 30 seconds goes by and they're sort of stuttering and wondering what they're, you know, and then they remember or something and then you start the next song. Whereas if they could just get it out, it's much better for everyone involved, isn't it?
Yeah, it can be. And again, it depends on your personality and what you're comfortable with, you know. Some people would feel really allergic to the idea of, you know, essentially having a speech written out, you know.
Yeah.
Whereas others, you know, and that's where the live album kind of changed a lot of the mystery around that was, like, I remember going and seeing NoFX play 21 years ago or something like that, and it was after the I Heard That They Suck Live album had come out.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that was because they were just screwing with people or what, because they kind of do whatever they want, but yeah. they pretty much had all the same banter
oh, really?
On stage as they did on the live record. And yeah. I knew that live record because I had it on cassette, and yeah. I would just have it in my Walkman and flip it over and over and over and listen to it. So I knew every single ridiculous joke they said, and they pretty much said it word for word.
Oh, man.
And it was like, oh. You know, it was like, it was when I went to... when I was younger, and I lived in the UK, and I went to, you know, wrestling, like WF wrestling or whatever.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And people were handing out the signs at the door, you know, saying like, you know, go The Undertaker or like, you know, Hulk Hogan's going to smash you or whatever. And I always had this idea that everyone was writing their own signs and bringing them, and that mystique got taken away.
You've just taken that away from me.
Sorry.
Oh, what?
Yeah. So, you know, everything... Yeah, I don't know.
Do you know if... it wouldn't surprise me if NoFX just were...
Were messing with people. Of course. Yeah, totally.
I've seen them a few times and they always find some way to piss you off.
Yeah, totally. I don't know. But then even having it really simple, just being like, you know, we plan in tuning breaks, for example.
Yep.
In our sets, it's like, where do you need to tune? Because... It's really boring watching people stop after every song and tune. And this will probably come up, but having a tuner is really, really important.
It doesn't come up. Have a tuner. Yeah.
Have a tuner. If you have a stringed instrument, have a tuner, a good tuner set up that you know how to use in line, meaning like it, you know, your lead goes into it. You don't have to unplug and plug into it.
Oh, God. Yeah, please.
But, I mean, I've had... bands that I considered to be very professional international touring bands that would be sitting on stage playing that song, bung, bung, you know, like tuning off each other. And it's just not good practice to have, I don't think, you know. And anyone can argue with that against me, that's fine. But it's just not fun to watch. It's not fun to...
Yeah, do what you want, right? Do what you want. If you want to tune on stage, then that's cool. But for me, as an audience member, it ruins the mystique. And it breaks me out of the kind of experience that I'm getting from the band.
Yeah, for sure.
In fact, one of the coolest ways around that that I've seen that was blacklisted.
Mm-hmm.
And they played...
they played here, actually.
Did they?
Yeah, yeah. Many years ago.
Yeah, quite a few years ago, they played at some youth centre in Auckland.
Mm.
And between songs, the guitarist would walk up and he just had a loop pedal and he'd already got a feedback loop that he'd programmed in. And between songs, he'd walk up and just go click. The song would end, you know, and he'd go click and it would go this big horrible noise of feedback loop. And then they'd turn their backs and tune. And when they were done, click, and then the next song starts.
Well, that's what that's what we do. Like we got a, you know, we're playing non-effects music for my band that I play at the moment, Master Blaster. And we had a delay pedal lying around. We've now set it up so that it's after the tuner for the guitarist. So if we have, at the end of songs, we just set it up on an infinite repeat loop. So we'll just ring out some horrible chord, turn it on, turn this tuner on, and so that there's just that swell of noise in between songs.
Yeah.
Ulcerate do it amazingly. The band that I do sound for, Mike just has all these different kind of atmospheric kind of delays and reverbs and things set up. So, you know, they finish a song and it just has this kind of low ambience.
So no one has to be sitting there in silence? No.
That's all it is. I mean, I'm constantly just feeding back my bass if we're not doing anything.
Yeah.
And it's annoying, like, because you can't hear what anyone's saying or anything, but it's like, but it's just that continuous nature of it, you know.
And then if
you're dead silence, you're using silence for as an advantage, you know. You know, because then if you stop, it's like you've got everyone's attention. Do you have something to say?
Yeah.
Or are you just going to stand this awkwardly for 10 minutes? You know.
And that's and especially in small gigs, it can be the awkwardness can be crippling.
Yeah, totally.
And it can make people want to leave. Hope Conspiracy played at Youth Zone in Hamilton. Years and years and years ago, and that was, they didn't have a thing to do between songs, and they just would stop, and it was Youth Zone, and everyone was silent.
Yeah,
and it was a Sunday or something. Yeah. No one was on the booze.
Yeah, it was Youth Zone in Hamilton. Of course, they weren't.
Yeah, and so it was totally just awkwardly, crushingly silent between songs, and I'll always remember that gig for that reason, not because Hope Conspiracy were actually fucking amazing.
Yeah, of course.
I remember the awkwardness between the songs. Yeah. I just wish they could have said something.
Yeah.
Anyway, set lists, have one. We're rehearsed. We've got a set list. Our gear is selling the best it can.
Mm-hmm.
We show up to the venue for sound check.
Mm-hmm.
Now, soundcheck is going through everything and checking your sound. So before we do that, punctuality, I think, is really important. Showing up on time to your soundcheck to give yourself the best chance of getting a soundcheck. And when you're getting a soundcheck, not messing around, being prepared. So it's your soundcheck time. It's not time to tune your drum kit. It's time to actually sound check. Can you kind of give us a quick run through on how a sound check works?
Yep. It's this thing that I do like 6 times a week.
Yeah, yeah.
And have done for a long time. Sure.
For those who've never experienced a sound check and they kind of show up to a venue and they go, what is
okay,
this
well,
thing?
I mean, again, it depends on the venue and the thing, but let's just say it's a, we'll use next door at Whammy as an example. It's a 200 capacity room. You have a sound engineer provided. It says on the sheet that doors are at 8:30 and loading and sound checks are from 6 p.m. Generally, an engineer will show up at around 5 o'clock. Hopefully, they've been advanced what sort of show it is, you know, like, there's a big difference between what they're setting up for if it's a DJ and an MC, or if it's a, you know, a 20-piece you know, noise band or something like that, for the kind of things that they need to set up. So they would have ideally set the PA and the monitors, your fallback speakers and all that kind of thing up. You show up, you load in at 6 o'clock. If you've got between 6 and 8:30 and you're, say, the headline act, which means you'll sound check first, generally it goes in reverse order. And quite often that'll mean that the headline act, meaning the last band of the night, will get a sound check, and then the first band of the night will get a more reduced sound check, which will often be called just a line check, just to check that all the lines are working.
Yep.
Band comes in, sets up the stage how they require it. The sound engineer clips all the mics on and starts getting sounds. Checking the sounds.
Checking the sounds.
Generally, that'll mean starting with the drums, getting the kick, the snare, toms, they get that all set up. Then they go to the bass, the guitars, if there's anything else like keyboards, etc. And then the vocals. Or sometimes they might start with the vocal, depending on the style of music or the type of engineer they are. They'll make sure you're happy with what you can hear on stage, and then save the settings one way or the other, and then you'll pack down your gear in quick time and then set that up on, and then they'll set up the first band and then work your way through.
Cool.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. So the ways that you can be ready for sound check obviously is to be there on time, like we just mentioned. Have your gear ready to go, as in your drum kit is tuned, your guitar is tuned, maybe your instruments are out of the cases, you know, kind of common sense there. Something that I think a lot of people struggle with is how to say what you want, and how to make sure that you get it when you don't really know, if you know what I mean. So what's the best way for people to communicate what they want from their sound, and then how do they know that what they're hearing when they're on stage during sound check is correct?
I reckon form a relationship with the sound engineer. So that could be going up to them and saying, hi, my name's Kane. I'm playing drums in the band. This is our setup. You know, we need three vocal mics. We've got two guitars, bass, drums, pretty straightforward. They'll be like, cool, hi, I'm so-and-so. that'll sound easy. Get up, start getting your sounds. One of the common, I think, mistakes is going, I want more me in my monitor. But you're playing keyboards, guitar, and vocals. Which one of those three things do you want? All of them? You know? And I think, or going, Simon needs more Frank.
We don't know who Simon
is. We don't know who Simon Frank are. We don't care, really. No. just blobs on stage, you know, one of you's hitting something and one of you's banging something, you know? So being real clear in that respect.
I need more piano in my monitor, please.
Yeah, totally, yeah. Helen would like some bass in their monitor over here, and could you please put some more bass in the bass player's monitor? Could there be some more vocal in the drum monitor, please? You know, making it kind of really kind of straightforward like that, I think. And the same thing I see happen, I mix monitors for a lot of bands, and there's a lot of body language reading that you have to do, whereby, you know, it might be the middle of a gig and someone's pointing at themselves and going up. But again, they're playing keyboards, guitar, and vocals, and you have to try and figure out
what
that is. And so that could be, there's some international, hand signals for, you know, a strummy. Like point at the bass player and go strummy, point at your monitor and go up or down or whatever.
Yeah.
Or go my vocal up or down while the gig's happening, obviously. Yeah. But, communicating really clearly, going, could I please have some more lead vocal in the guitarist's monitor? And generally having one person communicating.
Okay, that's interesting.
I've found that works well for my band. I generally am, just because of I'm a sound engineer. And I know I'll go up, I'll explain exactly what we need backline-wise, I'll explain exactly what we need setup-wise, because I sound like I know what I'm talking about. I'll automatically have a bit of a rapport with whoever it is I'm talking to, and then I'll go through and check the mics and things, and kind of direct a little bit.
Yep.
For that part, yep. Because that's something I can help with.
Yeah.
And I found that gets a much quicker, more accurate kind of thing. And also, if I know, I know that our drummer doesn't like vocals in his drum fill,
mm.
but that I need guitar on my stage left monitor, you know.
Mm.
And so learning some terminology can be helpful, like, for example, stage left and stage right, meaning mm-hmm. if you're standing on the stage and facing out, that's stage left and that's stage right.
Mm.
Just cool. A few bits and pieces like that.
Yep, mm. yep, great. Cool, so we're sound checking.
Mm.
Monitoring, mm. that's probably the biggest aspect that people struggle with.
Sure.
Musicians.
Mm-hmm. Turn your guitar down.
Yeah. Yeah, that's always the first thing, eh? Please yes. turn your guitar down.
And stop hitting your china so hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can the drummer play softer?
So, but then also, can the drummer play harder? So it's like, so this comes back to the rehearsal thing, I think, mm. and there's and recording yourselves. And if you're recording yourself in your practice space with a phone, and all you've got is vocals going through, like, it could be anything from some shitty speaker to a nice PA or whatever. If you can hear everything through your phone, you're probably doing quite well.
Yeah.
And theoretically, regardless of whether you're playing death metal or soul music, you should be able to, there should be a really good natural mix on stage from...
dynamics.
Yeah, or from all the instruments, you know? Because an engineer's job, technically, is sound reinforcement.
Yeah.
Meaning, like, they're not there to create a mix from scratch like you would in the studio, they're just reinforcing what you're putting out. So again, if your drummer's hitting really softly on the actual drums, but it's smacking the crap out of the cymbals, and then the bass player's turned up way too loud because they got real excited because they got a big bass rig for the first time or whatever, mm-hmm. and then the guitarist is playing through some little 5-watt practice amp because that's their sound, man, and you can't hear anything over it,
mm.
And then the vocalist is like whispering, you know, like you're not gonna end up with a good mix, and more importantly, you're not gonna end up with good monitoring for yourself.
So the first step to good monitoring is getting your sound right on stage.
Totally, and that can mean depending on the genre, but generally less is more. So if you can set it up so that it generally sounds, you can kind of hear everything, and all you need is vocals coming back, and maybe a bit of kick and snare here. The drummer will need the guitar and bass in their fallback, potentially, depending. then that's a really good starting point.
Yeah.
And so that means you've got good sounds at good levels in good placement on the stage. Mm. For example, I mentioned earlier on the last talk about having a little travel guitar head that we can run two cabs. That's purely for monitoring.
Mm.
So our guitarist carries an extra long speaker cable, and we always ask for two cabs, even though we've got one guitarist, and he's on stage right and runs out to another cab on stage left, which means I can hear him. I don't need to rely on a sound engineer to pull it back.
Yep.
It means straight off the bat, everything sounds good.
Yep.
You know, our drummer constantly records himself and we'll listen back. And if all you can hear on the recording is cymbals, hit your toms and your snare harder.
Yeah.
And maybe lighten off the cymbals, you know, like you should be able to get a good drum sound from one mic, theoretically.
Yeah, that's great advice. That's really great advice.
You know, like you should be able to.
Yep.
I was very fortunate. I just did, I just production managed Bonobo show, and their sound engineer used to be Sharon, King and the Deptones, front of house engineer.
Mm.
They'd use three mics on the drums, and sometimes that would just be like an SM57 laying on the floor between the kick and the snare. And this is at huge festivals.
Yeah,
they have three mics on the drums.
Wicked,
you know.
Wicked,
and that's how they get that vintage kind of cool sound.
Yeah,
because they have an amazing drummer who controls all their own dynamics. You know? and the first thing I'll do at a sound check will be, we'll make sure the drums are all set up, guitar and bass, we have our tones, and then we'll all stand back and we'll all just play, like, say, an A. Mm. Generally, we end up playing Blitzkrieg Bop by the Ramones, because it's just three chords. Mm. But just play that and go, okay, on stage, the guitars, drums, and bass are all kind of equal level.
Mm-hmm.
So then theoretically, and a singer can sing properly into a microphone, you know?
Yep, yep.
With good volume and directly onto the mic and not cup the microphone.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning having, you know, a hand over the grill, you know? Have it on the shaft of the mic. And then theoretically you should push it up and it will sound good. And generally it does, you know, because you put that bit of work into all that setup.
Yeah. Actually, in one of my old bands, we used to tour with an extra guitar cab,
right?
For the same reason, and we would run a cable to the cab, which would sit next to me, so that I could always hear my guitarist.
Yep.
Because quite often we're playing venues either with no monitoring,
yep,
or with very poor monitoring.
Yep.
So most likely the monitoring is going to be stage wedges.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go over, because with stage wedges, you run into the issue of feedback.
Mm-hmm.
How do we avoid feedback?
There's a number of ways. Hopefully you have an engineer who's been able to tune them well.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes if they're crappy wedges, you know, you're kind of rolling a turd and glitter, you mm-hmm. know, trying to make something sound good that can't. Again, less is more. Start with the vocals. What's the most important thing to come through them? It's the vocals.
Yep.
Okay. So let's get the vocals to a level. If you're singing like a foot off the microphone and really quietly, you know, the laws of physics dictate that it is impossible for you to get enough out of that speaker to get over your drummer that's behind you, for example, without there being a feedback loop caused, meaning that you're going to get squeals and all sorts of wonderful such things. Mm. Likewise, if you're right on the microphone, if you're using your classic SM58, the lollipop looking mic, I work with a lot of hip hop artists and I work with a lot of heavy music artists. They all love to what we call cup the mic, which is, you know, it looks really cool if you kind of like, if you've got your hand around the grill
singing into your fist.
And singing into your fist, and yeah, it looks really cool. It does. But what happens is, without getting too deep, is you're changing the polar pattern of that microphone from cardioid, meaning it's really direct singing in, to it's omnidirectional, meaning it picks up sound from everywhere, which means that it's more likely that the back of the mic's going to be picking up sound as well, which is where the speaker is, and you're more likely to be able to cause a feedback loop.
Yep.
So learning how to use a microphone correctly.
Cool,
mic technique, and anyone can Google correct mic technique. I'm sure you'll do some things on the podcast.
Totally.
About it.
Yep.
And you know, an engineer will love you for it, you know, because again, the more volume you can put out in a technically correct way into a microphone, it can only do so much. And a lot of people will have learned to do things like cup the mic because they've been playing in venues with poor PAs. And if you cup the mic, yes, it makes it omnidirectional, but it also generally makes it louder.
Yeah.
But it makes it louder. It makes it sound worse louder.
Makes your screams kind of different.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, if you run big systems and things like that, you know, there's still a lot of big professional acts that do it that have huge big systems and engineers who can deal with it. For the theoretical bands that we're talking about at the moment, you know, it's unlikely that's the case.
Yep.
So not asking for... not having your guitar down really quietly and asking for heaps of it through the foldback. Get your guitar to a good level where you can hear it at a good height.
Mm.
You know, a lot of guitarists will point their amps like directly at their ankles.
Yeah, true.
You know, if you've got a little combo amp or something, maybe
put it on a chair.
Put it on a chair or tilt it upwards.
Yeah.
And make sure it's at a volume that you can hear it, but it's not so loud that the engineer is trying to push all the other instruments through the PA to get on top of it.
Mm.
Which is, again, where that balance...
Yeah, it's a balance on stage.
It is.
Making sure everything kind of sounds...
Yeah.
Sounds good.
Totally.
And you're not pushing anything too much.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's great. Okay. What do you do if you can't hear yourself? What do you do? Do you just continue? Do you stop?
Never stop. Never call out the sound engineer on stage. It looks really bad.
Mm.
And you might be having the worst gig ever. And that's okay. And some bands have it as part of their shtick where they're like, you know, call out the sound guy. I just went to a hip-hop show at the Power Station this week. And there was this whole shtick on stage of the artists calling out the lighting guy and the sound guy and like being like, yo, where's my lighting guy at? You know, like, do this and do that and do this. And they'd do it. And then they'd be like, no, I meant this. And then eventually the lighting guy started fucking back with them and like they'd be like, turn it off. And it was just like, there were friends of mine who were the lighting and the sound engineers and the, you know, like, it was just like, this is such a bad way to put on a show, like, you know. And so if you're having difficulty, because some things happen, you know, like monitors might stop working. You might have the greatest sound engineer in the world working for you or with you. Things happen. Someone fell over the monitors because you were having a really great show and the monitors became unplugged.
Yep.
I need some more of my vocal in the monitor. Yo, sound person, I need some more vocal in my monitor. And it's like, no one wants to hear that. So maybe maintaining communication with the engineer from the get-go. Like, again, you introduce yourself.
Yep.
You make friends with...
Build rapport.
With her or him. Yeah. And then go... during the show, I might... You know, my vocals might get sore or whatever. And just maintain eye contact with them.
Mm.
Point at the mic and go up. Like
gestures.
That. Just gestures. Small gestures. But like, yo, stop. This sounds terrible.
Nothing more I say.
It's like, I've played some really bad sounding shows and it's like, you persevere and get used to it. Like, because either that's what sound check's for, and if you either didn't get a sound check or you didn't turn up for a sound check, then it's up to you to set it up as best as you can. That's where having all your instruments balanced and things like that, you know. And yep, there's some shows you're going to play where you're going to have no vocal monitoring and it's going to be really hard. And so it's about mitigating those kind of things. And maybe when you start not expecting an engineer or whatever to have the perfect mix dialed in straight away, it's kind of taking some responsibility for that. So that could be your band having a good setup and good balance. And then either the vocalist or someone in the band going through and just checking before you start that the vocals are loud enough in the monitors.
Yep.
And that takes getting used to.
Mm.
And then maintaining some sort of communication.
And keep going.
And keep going.
Yeah, I think obviously the worst thing you can do is stop. But it's thank you. It's largely about the audience's experience and from the audience's perspective. If you're... you know, stopping the show to call out the engineer, or you're being kind of rude, or I don't know, being awkward, then it pulls the audience out of your performance. Whereas maybe just a couple of gestures, whoever's watching might go, oh, they're experiencing a little bit of trouble. But if you continue, you know, the best you can, and you're still having a good time, that's going to reflect to the audience, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, you know, no one wants that to happen. So it's about kind of mitigating it first.
Yeah.
But then if it does happen, figuring that out. And that might mean you end your set earlier because it's becoming really hard for your vocalist. They're losing their voice because they're trying to push over it. Maybe it means they move out into the crowd so they can hear it out of front of house. Or they put an earplug in or something. You know, like, it's just, I think it's just about thinking about those things.
Yeah.
Anyway. And you can do whatever you want. If you want to stop a show and call out an engineer and obviously be having an awful time, that's fine. That's totally your prerogative. But it's not that fun to watch.
No.
And it's also not that fun to be... Having been every person in that equation, from a punter to a performer to a sound engineer, it's not that fun to be any of those three people when that's happening. So...
Yeah. Battle through, I say. Battle through.
Yeah.
And you're probably going to have to get used to battling through. The amount of gigs I've played with shitty sound is way too high.
Mm. Which is why we're talking about this, is about
how you can get it better.
Oh yeah, totally.
Yeah. Okay, so we've been talking about the sound engineer. I think we've covered a little bit of it. Obviously, build a rapport with the sound engineer, introduce yourself, explain clearly what you want. Don't this is coming from being a sound engineer as well.
Mm-hmm.
Don't expect too much of them in the way, you know, don't boss sound mm-hmm. engineers around. There's nothing that kind of annoys you more from the get-go when someone rocks in and sort of treats you like an employee or mm-hmm. something. That really gets to me. Sound engineers are professionals mm-hmm. and they should be treated as
some of them are. Such.
Well,
I've met a lot who's just Jim's mate from down the road
yeah.
who I've had to do sound for my own bands. I can yeah. tell some great stories. I actually just met a guy who was in Germany who was like, do you remember me? I did sound for your band at that festival in New Zealand. And I was like, do you mean the festival where you took acid and were tripping so hard you forgot to set up the whole PA? And so I had to set up the PA and mix my own band. Mm. And he's like, yeah, that was me.
It was me.
Like, he's considered a professional, but it's a very different level of professional.
Yeah. Yeah. basically, my approach as a musician approaching sound engineers has always been to try and be friends with them because although most professional sound engineers will try and make you sound really good regardless,
mm-hmm.
it can't help. It can't hurt if, you know, if you are friendly with them. They might be more inclined to help you a bit better, I think.
Totally. I think that whole working with people rather than for or whatever yeah. is an important thing. And just some really basic communication things. Like there's, if it's someone who you've heard mix before, you've seen them mix the other bands or whatever, there's just some really basic ideas, which is what sort of sound are you going for?
Mm.
And generally that all that might mean is, do you want lots of reverb and delay on your vocals or do you want it to be quite dry
mm.
with no reverb and delay on it? Or that kind of thing. Or what kind of style is your band? And it's like, oh, it's kind of dreamy pop. Okay, cool. That you're going to mix that differently than if it's a metal band.
Yeah, totally. You
know? You'd hope.
Yep. So I think the moral of the story is to build a relationship with them and to kind of form an understanding and it can't help to buy them a beer.
Totally.
now...
Or at least offer.
We've gone over how to communicate what you want. I've got something written down here that says, do you bring your own engineer or do you use the in-house engineer?
Mm.
And I think it's entirely dependent on situation,
mm-hmm.
Whether you know someone
mm-hmm.
and have a friend that's a reliable sound engineer that will do you a solid, whether you have the budget to pay a professional engineer, whether the house provides one, and then whether that house engineer is any
mm-hmm.
good.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it comes down to how important it is to you, because in many cases, the sound engineer is the person who dictates how you sound exactly to your audience.
Oh, totally.
So, yeah,
you can do whatever you want on stage.
Yeah.
And you've got no idea out there. Mm. But also that comes down to your monitoring as well. I think some of the bands that I tour with, the reason why they take me is, yes, I give a good representation at the front. And so that represents their band and all their efforts and aesthetic well. But more importantly, I go in and I just do a quick tune of the monitors, meaning that I fix any kind of weird indiscrepancies. And give them exactly what they want so they have an enjoyable gig. And that comes right back to having the right gear, having the, you know, being comfortable with your sounds and tones and all that kind of stuff. It's like, if you can hear everything, you're having so much more of a better gig.
Yeah, you know? And that will come across to your audience as well.
Mm.
Now, lastly, I want to talk about drugs and alcohol. I've found that booze and drugs present quite a big hurdle for a lot of people,
mm-hmm.
In young bands especially.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to get your thoughts on playing drunk versus playing sober.
Mm-hmm. It's totally a case-by-case example, I think. And also depending on what instrument you're playing. Mm. I think generally people who say I play better when I'm wasted mean that they perceive themselves to play better when they're wasted. You know, unfortunately, the alcohol and music industries are, you know, inextricably linked together, to the point where I own a music venue and get to bring all these amazing bands through and I'm super proud of it. but if I wasn't selling booze, the venue wouldn't exist, and therefore the space, you know, like in this particular context within New Zealand, that's the way that the music industry works, and sponsorship, and you know bands are given free beer before they're given free food, and you know, like, so there's a lot of that that goes on that it's just a fact of it. And because of that, you know, bands will often be like, how many beers can I get, or whatever. I find if it's a touring band, like if you're playing a lot of shows, quite often a vocalist can find it really hard to drink and perform night after night, because it ends up wrecking your throat and things. Probably not least of all because you end up yelling at people when you're talking really loudly and drunk and ranting
after
at them.
After the
gig or whatever. Or you go harder or you do things differently. Drummers, I think, tend probably to get a bit sloppier if they're wasted. So I think it's all about kind of moderation. I think I find it quite difficult personally to play completely sober. In any of the I think that's just it's a historical thing. I think, you know, I used to party really hard, and I started in bands when I was younger, and then I stopped for a long period of time, but by that point I was already quite comfortable on stage, so I kind of had so I didn't have that whole kind of nerves thing, so I could quite happily be sober on stage, but now I quite enjoy having a couple of drinks or whatever beforehand.
Yeah.
But not, I don't enjoy being out of control on stage.
Yeah.
You know, like I had a show recently where I'm playing really, really fast, and we traveled quite a long way, and then alcohol affects you quite differently. And I was playing, and all of a sudden I realized that I'd probably had a few too many, and, you know, my fretboard, like, it's just a blur, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm going through, and I actually played a really great show, but I felt like I wasn't quite in control the whole time. And so I think it's obviously down to the person. I've got friends who won't play unless they absolutely smash their minds, and some who absolutely will not have a beer until after the show as happened. You know, they have to be dead cold sober for the show for performance wise. It's totally up to you.
Up to the person.
Yeah, it's up to the person. It's up to the genre, it's up to everything, you know? Like, and particular drugs have far more of a presence in particular scenes, you know?
Yeah.
And sometimes it can, like anything, breaking down inhibitions. If you're going to be doing this big performance, sometimes having some courage can help. Yeah. But yeah, my personal, I mean, I could talk a lot about both of these topics, but without incriminating myself too much, but, you know?
My personal experience is that the drunker I am, the sloppier I am.
Mm-hmm.
And it might be just a drummer trait.
I think that's just a trait, I think.
Yeah. I think it's for everyone. And I always advise people to not play drunk. Nothing wrong with having a drink, maybe, if you can handle. I usually have one beer before I play.
Right.
And I've got a rule, you know, and that's my personal.
Yeah, cool.
One, maybe two, if I'm feeling.
Maybe six.
Maybe, nah. Maybe six, and then I have a crappy gig because I'm sloppy, and then I feel bad about it.
And again, it comes back to, why are you doing?
Yeah, you put all that effort into it,
and then
for the extra couple of beers, you kind of just ruined that opportunity.
Totally. Yeah, for sure. And I mean, and it totally depends. I mean, I have quite a high tolerance. Like, I can imbibe a lot of intoxicants and still appear quite in control from years of practice, you know? Whereas I know people who could have half as much as I do and be absolutely out of their minds, you know? It depends on whether you've eaten, all those kind of things. But but the touring game particularly is very focused around alcohol and drugs, depending on what scene and group you're in, you know? Like, the number of bands that come through, that the first question is, you know,
Do we get beers?
Or, you know, where can I get some weed? Or, you know, what do you got, kind of thing, you know, like from high level to lower level. And that could be for just during the day or after the gig or whatever, but, you know, drugs and alcohol are a massive part of music. And so it's all down to how people handle that, really. But I haven't seen an amazing gig where people have been absolutely smashed out of their minds.
No.
I've seen amazing gigs where people have definitely been on something, but in control. Mm. But someone else might have taken the same amount of drugs or alcohol as them and put on a really crappy gig. So
usually when you see someone that's really wasted, especially at an amateur level, which is kind of where we're hanging out.
Right.
It's embarrassing.
Yes, totally.
More than anything else.
Yes, for sure.
Yeah.
So yeah, don't be an embarrassment until at least after the show.
Yeah.
And even then, don't be an embarrassment, because the amount of bands that then get wasted and then be a dick to the bar staff, or be a dick to someone else in the venue, or the sound engineer or whatever, you know? So basically having some degree of control.
Mm.
I have a blessing and a curse where I can stay somewhat in control even if I'm quite out of it. So, but I'm very aware of times where it's like, I need to take myself home now.
Yeah.
Because I shouldn't be in public.
I mean, in the end, it comes down to what you said before. You've put all that effort into it. Don't blow it.
Yeah,
totally. Over a couple of beers.
Yeah.
When you can just wait.
Yeah,
and
for sure.
Do it another time.
Yeah, totally.
Okay, so hopefully we've shed some light on how to give you the best chance of sounding good on stage and to your audience. Tom, thank you so much, mate.
Cheers, thank you.
Your expertise and your time is incredibly valuable. So that's it for part two. That's it for Tom. And my band of the week is Master Blaster. It's Tom's band. Check him out. Black Paint from Master Blaster. Check them out and buy their music at masterblaster.bandcamp.com. And that's the podcast for this week. Thank you so much for listening and or watching on YouTube. The Musicians Map podcast is part of the Musicians Map website, musiciansmap.org, where you can find lots more articles and videos, as well as my ebook and audiobook about growing success in music. In that book, you'll find experienced-based advice about every aspect of learning music, from listening and learning an instrument to recording, gigging, touring, and making money as a musician. For those of you wanting to get serious about your musical journey, I offer one-on-one development sessions and song critiques, which are honestly an incredible way to gain the focus and direction required to achieve your goals, whatever they might be. I've also got a free 5-day challenge to a clear musical pathway. In the 5-day challenge, you will learn how to define your taste and clear your path, how to expand your horizons and exploit your musical potential, how to become a better musician just by listening, how to discover your niche and make it work for you, and how to set achievable goals and actually follow through. And it's totally free. So once again, head to musiciansmap.org to take advantage of all the resources on offer. As promised, I have a free gig prep checklist to download and go through before your next gig. Go to musiciansmap.org/gig-prep
checklist to download your free PDF, or check the text associated with this podcast for your free download link. Thanks again for listening, and thanks so much to my guest, Tom Anderson, for the past 2 episodes. What a dude. He's been absolutely incredible, and he's such a wealth of knowledge. Hopefully, we're going to have him back one day. So please get in touch with your comments, suggestions, and let me know what challenges you are facing at the moment over at the Musicians Map Facebook group. I always respond. I look forward to hearing from you. Stay positive.